the strongest support I found were with the other widows who also lost their husbands on that day in that crash.
The Medal of Freedom for an Alaskan who turned grief into an opportunity to help thousands of others. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, November 24th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a pilot project works to help patients recover from a major medical crisis.
We want to fill something that doesn't exist so that people don't have to navigate this very confusing medical system alone.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP Alaska. As part of their commitment to Alaska, BP and their employees are investing in over 400 education and service organizations in communities across the state. More at alaska.bp.com.
And by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Pebble Partnership has dropped many of its subpoenas to individuals and organizations in its case against the Environmental Protection Agency. The partnership had been trying to cast a large net to capture communication between those opposed to a mine in the Bristol Bay watershed and the EPA as part of Pebble's lawsuit alleging the agency acted improperly. KDLG's Molly Dishner has more.
The Pebble Limited Partnership wants to build what could be the world's largest gold and copper mine in Bristol Bay, and the EPA has worked to use Clean Water Act protections to prevent that from happening. But Pebble says the agency violated federal rules in its efforts to do so, and had previously requested to subpoena more than 60 individuals and groups to help prove its case. After last week's decision by Federal District Court Judge H. Russell Holland that quashed some of Pebble's subpoenas, saying they pushed the envelope, Pebble Partnership spokesman Mike Heatwall says the company has withdrawn some of its other requests to comply with that order.
Well, for now, it's probably important to just emphasize that we're going to focus our discovery efforts on the EPA and as our filing indicated that if we conclude there's a need for further non-party discovery, then we certainly will intend to pursue that.
Trustees for Alaska represents a handful of those who were subpoenaed. Nunamta Aluxtai, Cook Inlet Keeper, Groundtooth Trekking, Kim Williams, Tim Troll, and Tom Tilden. All of those have been withdrawn. Staff attorney Michelle Sinnott says that's good news.
These are people who love Bristol Bay, who have been working really hard to protect, you know, a world-class watershed. This is their backyard. These are things that they care about. And to be drawn into this federal litigation, it's very expensive.
Other withdrawn subpoenas include the National Resources Defense Council, some out-of-state consulting groups, and Shoren Brown, who worked on Trout Unlimited's campaign to protect Bristol Bay. Other subpoenas remain, although Heatwall says he thinks the company intends to withdraw them. In Dillingham, I'm Molly Dishner.
President Obama this evening bestowed the Medal of Freedom on Alaskan Bonnie Carroll. She's a military widow who founded a service organization called TAPS to help family members of those who die in uniform. Many of the 16 others honored with her at the White House today are household names and Hollywood icons like Willie Mays, Barbara Streisand, James Taylor, and Steven Spielberg. Carroll may not be as well known, but as APRN's Liz Ruskin reports, her life was already cinematic.
As President Obama put it, when Bonnie Carroll's world turned upside down, she healed by helping others.
And each year, TAPS holds seminars and workshops for military families across the country. Through their Good Grief camps, they bring together children of our fallen to learn how to cope with loss, to honor the legacy of their heroes, and to try and have some fun as well. As one Gold Star child who lost her father in Iraq said, because of TAPS, I know someone is by my side.
The award is the nation's highest civilian honor. But Carroll's journey never lacked for superlatives. Consider her love story. In 1988, Carroll was a West Wing aide drawn into an unfolding drama in the Alaskan Arctic. A family of gray whales was marooned in a rapidly freezing ocean. President Reagan asked Carroll to offer White House assistance. So Carroll called the commander of the Alaska National Guard, Tom Carroll, and he turned out to be the love of her life. Their story is a plot line in Big Miracle, a Hollywood movie about the whale saga.
We will do everything we can to help these poor creatures.
The National Guard will pull the icebreaker where it's desperately needed.
The pull should be a piece of cake.
Nothing's that simple in the Arctic.
They married in real life, and Carol moved to Anchorage, where she worked in the district attorney's office. Then, in 1992, General Carol and seven other soldiers died when their plane crashed as they approached Juneau. Bonnie Carol, speaking just before the White House ceremony, recalled how stunned she was.
It does not sink in for a very long time that something of that magnitude is real. It's impossible to comprehend. You cannot possibly understand at that moment that you will never see that person again.
At the DA's office and as a volunteer, Carol had worked with crime victims. She had even helped family members cope with a prior military plane crash.
And, you know, I really thought with all this experience and training, when the Army Guard crash happened, I thought, well, I'll be able to help everybody. I'm so, you know, I'm prepared. And that fantasy lasted about 30 seconds.
When your heart finally allows your brain to grasp the enormity of it, Carol says, the grief is debilitating.
But the strongest support I found were with the other widows who also lost their husbands on that day in that crash.
From that experience, she founded the Tragedy Assistance Program for Survivors in 1994. The nonprofit, like so much else, transformed after 9/11. Carol says TAPS and the Red Cross were the only two organizations within the Pentagon's Family Assistance Program.
So we were there on the front line for those families. And today, many of the Pentagon surviving families are now peer mentors to our newly bereaved of today. So from that, we really transitioned very quickly into a whole new organization with a new level of response and care.
With the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Carol says the family members helped by TAPS grew to 50,000. She says she's not exactly sure how she came to be considered for the Medal of Freedom.
We're very blessed to have the support of the Commander-in-Chief, who personally recognizes service and sacrifice. I don't know who actually did the nominating, but I take this as a recognition of the sacrifices made by this nation.
Among others honored with Carol were baseball great Yogi Berra, Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski, and violinist Yitzhak Perlman. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
In Alaska, we understand how forecasting weather is important. But it turns out in space, it plays a critical role as well. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, a University of Alaska Fairbanks scientist is helping satellite jockeys avoid collisions.
UAF space physicist Mark Conde has helped develop instruments to measure winds and temperature 100 miles above the Earth. Conde admits, as rarefied as conditions are that high up, the atmosphere can act like a fluid, and getting accurate readings is important to NASA and other space agencies. With something like 500,000 pieces of space junk circling the Earth, operators want to know how much to shift their satellites to avoid collisions.
A change in the density of the atmosphere, which would come about from a change in temperature or a change in the wind, will alter where their spacecraft will be predicted to be, a few days in advance.
Conde says the higher the latitude, the better positioned instruments are to accurately gauge conditions. He says one already stands on Alaska's north coast, so positioning devices in Antarctica is ideal.
You go to McMurdo and be at 78 degrees latitude south, and go to the South Pole and be right at the pole at 90 degrees latitude.
Moreover, he says the instrument headed to McMurdo was built in-house at the Geophysical Institute's machine shop. The installation is scheduled for next month, close to the height of Antarctica's summer. Conde or a grad student will travel south to operate the equipment next year. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
A Wasilla man is missing in the Hatcher Pass area near Palmer, and now a series of avalanches are hampering search efforts. This morning, an avalanche blocked Hatcher Pass Road, leaving a pile of snow and debris 14 feet high, according to State Department of Transportation spokesperson Jill Reese.
The avalanche came down at about milepost 15, which is just around the Archangel Road, and closed the road totally. From what I understand, it's about 100 feet wide and about 14 feet deep. Traffic is being turned around at the Gold Mint parking lot, which is at about milepost 14.
Severe avalanche danger due to a warming trend is making efforts to locate missing skier 33-year-old Liam Walsh difficult. Alaska State Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says Walsh was last seen around noon on Sunday. He had told family he was going skiing in Hatcher Pass. Family members contacted state troopers on Monday when Walsh failed to return. Troopers have located Walsh's car in a Hatcher Pass parking lot, but weather conditions have kept responders out of the backcountry. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, volunteers hand out hundreds of Thanksgiving on Anchorage.
It's basically your duty to give back. That's how humanity should be, you know. We should look at each other and want to take care of each other, you know.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
The road from illness to recovery is often difficult. In the middle of a major health crisis, patients are expected to navigate the complicated healthcare system. A pilot program called Alaska Innovative Medicine in Anchorage is rounding out its first year, trying to improve that journey for patients while also spending fewer healthcare dollars. APRN's Annie Feit has the story.
In the early morning hours of April 8th, Brian Somm felt horrible.
Every time I laid down, I could feel something boiling in my chest. And then I'd throw up, and then I'd lay back down. And I went through this process three, four, five times.
It was a heart attack, and it nearly killed Somm. While he was recovering in the hospital, he got a call from a social worker who said she was with Alaska Innovative Medicine, and her services were free. She visited Somm at home. At first, he was skeptical.
Because I didn't know who she was or what this was. All I know is I was real sick, and I just got home from the hospital after 2 weeks.
That medical social worker was Gigi Rigg, and it didn't take long for her to win Somm over. Rigg gave Somm her cell phone number. When his medication made him feel strange, he called her, and she had him talk to a nurse who could troubleshoot the issue. Another time, Somm's hand swelled up strangely, the type of episode that could have easily sent him to the ER. Instead, he called Rigg, and she connected him with a doctor.
We want to fill something that doesn't exist so that people don't have to navigate this very confusing medical system alone.
Rigg even went to appointments with Somm as another set of eyes and ears and to help translate complicated medical jargon. Rigg's goal and the goal of Alaska Innovative Medicine is to keep patients on track.
It's just a hard thing to do alone, and it's hard to figure out when you don't know the healthcare system. You know, I think family and support systems try to be helpful, but it's like, okay, here, now we're going to speak Japanese only in the house, you know? Wait, I don't know Japanese, but I'm going to try.
A group of Anchorage doctors established Alaska Innovative Medicine, or AIM, in January. It's a pilot project funded by the insurer Premera Alaska and focused on their members. So far, AIM has worked with more than 800 patients. Noah Laufer is a primary care doctor in Anchorage who helped establish AIM and is now a board member. He says the idea is to coordinate care between different doctors to reduce the barriers that prevent patients from getting better. And who is best suited to do that? Laufer says one big lesson from this experiment, it's not the doctors.
It turns out that the social worker or case manager is often the most important person on the team by far.
Social workers and case managers are problem solvers. They can communicate with a team of doctors, the insurer, and the patient to address pesky issues that seem simple but can quickly derail a recovery. Laufer gives the example of a patient who shows up at a pharmacy with a prescription to take a pill 3 times a day, but the benefits management company will only allow the medicine 2 times a day.
The pharmacist, you know, is behind the counter for 20 minutes and comes back and says it's not covered. There's no one for them to go to, and they throw up their hands, sometimes in despair, and leave without the medicine they need. And this is exactly the kind of systemic hurdle. No one is intentionally doing something bad, but the outcome is not acceptable.
Insurer Premera Alaska thinks AIM can give their members better care at a manageable cost. Patients love the program, and Premera is encouraged by preliminary data that shows the pilot project is beginning to help reduce hospital readmissions and trips to the ER. That's certainly been Brian Somm's experience. He hasn't had to return to the hospital or had an ER visit since he was discharged nearly 8 months ago. He started to think about going back to work, and Somm's made some big personal changes.
I used to drink quite a bit when I came home from work. I don't drink or smoke anymore. Big change.
How did you do that?
When somebody tells you it's going to kill you, you'll stop doing it.
Somm says on a bad day, he thinks about having a drink or a smoke, but he's not about to let that happen. In Anchorage, I'm Annie Feit.
Many Alaskan school districts don't offer high enough salaries to recruit and retain qualified teachers. That's according to a new study the state commissioned to look at a possible standardized salary schedule. But as KDLG's Hannah Colton reports, the study found that pay schedule would be too expensive and perhaps not enough to solve Alaska's teacher retention problem.
About 65% of teachers in Alaska come from out of state. In recent years, Alaskan school districts have had a harder time recruiting new teachers, and the state also has relatively fewer highly qualified teachers, meaning those with specialized training in their subject area, than other states. In 2014, former Governor Sean Parnell addressed these issues in an education bill that called for several studies. In one, the UAA's Center for Alaskan Education Policy Research was tasked with coming up with a standardized teacher salary schedule that some hoped would save the state money. Diane Hirschberg is the center's director and led the study.
We want the best possible teachers in our schools. So one of the questions we had was, what do you need to pay in order to be able to attract and retain highly qualified teachers, but without overpaying?
To figure out this magic salary number for different places throughout the state, the researchers looked at cost of living factors in each school district.
What does it cost to fly to and from a community? What is the distance from a hub community or from Anchorage or Fairbanks? You know, what are the number of degree heating and degree cooling days?
They also looked at teacher turnover data for each district. And putting all those factors together, Hirschberg's team calculated how much each district should be paying in order to keep teachers. There was only one district they determined is paying just the right amount.
The Matsu Central area, so Palmer, Wasilla, Kinnick, they seem to have hit that spot where they're paying pretty much 100% highly qualified teachers who are staying with their current salary schedule.
The study found teachers are overpaid in just three districts, Fairbanks, Juneau, and Sitka. Everywhere else, it said, schools are not paying enough. The most extreme case is the Pelican School District in Southeast, where a standardized pay schedule would call for salaries to more than double. In the end, researchers did not recommend the state go with a standardized pay schedule like this. For one, Hirschberg says it would be too expensive, and it would take fiscal decisions away from local school boards.
To have the state say to one community, you need to raise your salaries that much, might really place them in a terrible position vis-a-vis meeting heating bills.
Ultimately, Hirschberg says, the data show that keeping good teachers is about more than just numbers on a contract. The study recommends the state look into other factors that help new teachers feel more supported, whether that's building better teacher housing or providing more professional development.
If some of that work happened, it might change the calculation in the long run. So that instead of saying we need to pay teachers 80% more, maybe we need to pay teachers 30% more, but now we've created working conditions where they're much more likely to feel successful and want to stay.
The study has been published and presented to the House Legislative Budget and Audit Committee. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. Condor Airlines, with nonstop service from Ted Stevens International Airport to Germany and beyond. More information available on condor.com. Condor, born to fly. and by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
For the 31st year in a row, Central Lutheran Church in downtown Anchorage is providing Thanksgiving dinners for people in need. They started with 39 families, and now they serve 1,400. But KSKA's Urban Affairs reporter Ann Hillman learned sometimes getting a turkey dinner home requires some creativity.
Sweat drips from under Peyton Algafa's Santa Claus hat as he grabs a bag of apples and potatoes and scurries to a table filled with canned vegetables.
What we have is green beans and corn.
He's helping Barbara Moxie pick up her Thanksgiving dinner basket, complete with stuffing, cranberries, and a turkey with a baking pan. She's got everything she needs within 3 minutes, and she looks a little stunned.
It was funny. Like, it was so fast.
I know.
Not like last year. Last year was really slow.
Lutheran Social Services Executive Director Alan Budal says it took 6 months of planning, over 100 volunteers, and thousands of donated cans of vegetables to get to this point. Central Lutheran is one of 12 different distribution sites around Anchorage in the Valley that will provide food to more than 10,000 families this holiday, including turkeys ordered by the food bank back in January. Volunteers started setting up at 6 a.m., A group of 8th graders inspects bags of apples.
We are
quality
packaging
control.
Apples.
Quality control?
We'll yeah. Make sure they aren't rotten.
Other volunteers cautiously load tables with cans.
A couple of our tables are a little older, so we're worried that this one's going to go.
But the table is still standing when Aogafa zips through. He's surprisingly high energy, given that he went straight to the church after working a graveyard shift.
I'm starting to get a little delirious. I mean, I didn't know there was going to be so many stairs that we're going to have to go up and down. I'm sweating. You know what? I'm knocking out two birds with one stone. My doctor said I needed to walk because, you know, I'm getting a little heavy, so I'm walking.
Aogafa signed up to volunteer for the event with a group of friends.
I've always felt that, you know, if you've been blessed and taken care of, that, you know, it's basically your duty to give back, you know. I mean, that's how humanity should be, you know. We should look at each other and want to take care of each other, you know.
Outside the church, a line of people waiting to register snakes through the parking lot. On the other side of the building, people plan how to get their turkeys home. Some have cars, others take the bus. Edwin Bratz says the food is too heavy to carry the 10 blocks home, so he's devised another method.
It's a box with a hole. And I put my food in there, and I use my pants belt to drag it home, like a sled.
How are you keeping your pants up?
With my other hand. See, they're falling already.
So you think you'll be able to get home like that?
Yeah, that's why I got 3 boxes. One break, I use the other one. So by the third one, I should be home.
And with that, he takes off, ready to cook Thanksgiving dinner for his girlfriend and his kid. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
In Alaska, the number of fluent Haida speakers has dwindled down into the single digits. It's been called an endangered language, but in Juneau, a group is trying to change that. Haida Language Learners is using YouTube, Snapchat, and Instagram to reach a wider audience. KTOO's Elizabeth Jenkins has more.
Emily Rose Edenshaw shows me her phone. She's been using a flashcard app to practice Haida. It's totally customizable. She can create the cards and share them with her teachers and friends. On one of the cards, is a picture of a horse grazing in a field, and it's broken down by cuts of meat.
And then the second picture is a cartoon, the one in English, saying I have horse meat for sale. It's a picture of a horse head inside a burger.
I should point out, it's a costume horse head.
Yeah,
not like a real horse head.
A cartoon horse head, you know, and it just, for me, it just makes it funny and it makes it more interesting. Today's Haida phrase is skusi dukin.
Haida's arrived in Southeast a few hundred years ago. Some left their ancestral village of Haida Gwaii, which is now part of Canada. They settled in villages on Prince of Wales Island. Edenshaw says Haida's grammar structure is similar to Spanish. And like Spanish, it can sound like a foreign language.
Being native, you're kind of disappointed that you don't know your own heritage language. It's hard to work past that sometimes.
Edenshaw has practiced Haida for over a decade. Her family moved to Heidelberg when she was a kid, and she started picking words up.
You know, like thank you, howa, huxta, hurry up. You hear that one a lot.
But she says it was hard to learn more complex phrases. In college, she was able to take a free class taught by a linguist.
And then after that, I really fell in love with the language, and I wanted to write poetry in Haida. I wanted to dream in Haida, so I continued to practice with it.
She says part of that meant finding someone to speak Haida with, to use words and phrases that are relevant in conversation today.
Hello, today's word is Hinda, and that's Goe. Hinda.
Eden Shaw met Susie Lee Hinda. Edwardson in Haida class. Hinda. In their YouTube Hinda. Video, a picture of Grumpy Cat flashes on the screen. You know, Grumpy Cat, celebrity meme. It's had over 200 views. Their YouTube channel has about 145 subscribers, which may not seem like a lot. But remember, Alaska's fluent Haida speakers are in the single digits. Edwardson has been studying it about 3 years. And she says she didn't grow up speaking the language. Her parents spoke a word here and there.
But in my head, they were just saying something weird, and it didn't really connect with me as it was something that's part of me. But when I got into college and I started learning the language, and I started learning the language with my family, it just felt really good, and it felt like you're going into a community that you weren't a part of all your life.
The number of fluent Haida speakers has been declining for the last 100 years. Boarding schools enforced a strict ban on native languages. Edwardson says it's a serious topic, but they're trying to make learning Haida fun. It's involved some compromise. She took down one of their YouTube videos because some found it offensive. In that video, she said the Haida word for penis. Okay, maybe they took it a little further and said tiny penis. But Edwardson says they don't want to offend anyone.
Like, the little radical in me is like, it's the language, but at the same time, we want it to be accessible. And if families are going through the YouTube videos and they find something that they don't want their kids to learn yet, I don't want them to stay away from the language.
Then there's also the issue of finding ways to express modern notions. But Eden Shaw says that's totally doable.
We asked the elders, you know, what would make this work? What can we do to translate this into Haida so we'll all understand it? And then we can use just Haida vocabulary and we can express ourselves and our thoughts and what we're doing nowadays.
The Haida phrase for computer literally means the box that knows everything. A cell phone is a purse phone or a wallet phone.
Spinach is now iron leaf in Haida.
And she says having the web to connect with others has been huge. Haida Language Learners has received messages from a teenage fan in New York. They've helped people in remote communities say goodbye to a loved one in Haida. Eden Shaw recently quit her day job to focus on language revitalization full-time. And she wants people to know, Haida isn't dead.
We can bring back the language. You know, we can't bring back every single piece of the culture, but we can bring back the important parts that will make us feel whole and feel right with the world.
She hasn't dreamed in Haida yet, but she is writing poetry. In Juneau, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Molly Dishner and Hannah Colton in Dillingham, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Robert Hannon in Fairbanks, Ann Hillman and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, and Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the Red Dog Mine, committed to environmental excellence. Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far. And by Crowley, providing marine petroleum distribution and energy support services throughout Alaska since 1953, supporting business development while helping safeguard the environment. More at CrowleyAlaska.com. Alaska Pacific University is accepting applications for all undergraduate programs for the spring 2016 semester. More at AlaskaPacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.